You're listening to Signal to Noise on the Pro Sound Web Podcast Network. This episode is brought to you by the following sponsors: Allen & Heath and their new CQ series, a trio of compact digital mixers for musicians and bands, audio engineers, home producers, small venues, and AV installers, placing ease of use and speed of setup at the heart of the user experience. RCF, who just unveiled their new TT Plus audio brand, including the high-performance GTX series line arrays, and the GTS-29 subwoofer. Be sure to check it out at rcf-usa.com. That's rcf-usa.com. I wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be. I wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Signal to Noise on the Pro Sound Web Podcast Network. I'm your host, Andy Levis, and with me, as usual, is my partner in crime, my unindicted co-conspirator, Mr. Sean Walker. What's up, Sean?
What's up, y'all? What's up, dude? I'm, hanging out, jet-lagged like a motherfucker.
as we do. And I'm sitting here in an annexed vocal warm-up room at a theater right now, popping in before I start a call for an oratorio I'm mixing tonight.
There you go. Giddy up, dude.
Some operatic chorale kind of stuff for a change.
Totally. But I wouldn't have it any other way. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Glad to be working. Glad to be doing what we love.
Totally, dude. Well, that's it. Without too much further ado, let's introduce our guest, because we're all on a tight time crunch today. We got a friend of a friend of mine, Burton here, who is front of house for Madonna and Post Malone, and we thought maybe we'd chat about some cool mixing cool rock shows. Hey, Burton, how are you? Right.
I'm great, man. Thanks for having me, guys. So excited.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, dude, thanks for coming. Here. I mean, I suppose we should rewind back to the start and do the cliche, like, how do you end up here? At least the short version, how do you end up in audio? And then we can talk about how you ended up here with Madonna.
Stuck with us.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah. That's a life choice he'll just question for the rest of his life after today.
Love it. Hey, you know, one of the great things about our industry is the friendships in the network we get to experience, right?
And
that's,
totally.
That's like, what is that like a plus added benefit to it? You know, you meet great people, and you know, just totally. Just to be able to share this level of creativity, you know, with your friends and stuff like that. So long story short, grew up in church, right? So I've got a lot of exposure to different genres of music, because you know, in church worship, you've got a little bit of everything. Had the experience of messing with audio since I was about 9 years old. As far as, it's not just playing your instruments, but sometimes in church you got to mic up your own instrument, you got to do your own thing. And then from there, you know, the love of audio just began through the years, studio work. And then in my 20s, started full-on professional work. And that brought me into the touring market, as well as starting a regional, you know, company of my own that was very successful. And that gave me a lot of exposure also, because, you know, I was doing gigs for, you know, X, Y, and Z for all kinds of, you know, different events and different bands. Did a lot of club work, did a very musical club in Queens, New York, you know, that had just about every genre of music come by, you know, and I've been there for a long time. I remember even raves like Rabbit in the Moon, if you remember, you know, stuff from back then all the way to, you know, all kinds of reggae shows. Bands out of France would come by, you know, and then you'd get all that exposure. And, you know, what a great place that I had to be able to train professionally also, you know?
And I realized you were a New York guy, so...
100%. Nice. Yeah, not much of an accent, but, you know, but this is my place.
I'm getting tag-teamed over here. You East Coasters, tag-team.
Love Seattle, though.
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
Cool. So like, so you were working at the club, and then at what point did you make the, was touring always the goal? Like, did somebody you meet there, no, kind of bring you out, or?
You know, to be honest, touring was never the goal. My personal goal was always to become a better mixer. So even if I was just mixing in the box and, you know, or mixing in the club, my joy came from just mixing, right? I wasn't chasing after the money. I wasn't chasing after, you know, the big tours or anything like that. It just kind of fell into place with, like we mentioned, you know, this, the networking of this industry and people you meet, you know, and I was able to give into a life, a friend of mine, right, who is also in the industry now. I think he's currently in the UK. He's on a tour also. But, you know, I was able to mentor him and get him going in the industry. You know, I think I remember I always tell him, I told him one time, if you stick with me, I'll get you places, right? And I'll teach you everything you need to know about this industry or and about sound in general.
I think I need to stick with you, bro. Can you get me places? Can you teach me what I need to know?
We've been trying to teach you for a while, Sean.
Yeah, dude, I'm a lost cause, bro.
Oh boy. then we'll have to turn them over to lighting or video.
I'm not pretty about to be on video, dude. I got a face for radio. You know what I mean?
Oh, I got you. You
can go LED, bro. Though
LED yeah, right? World. Yeah, there you go. There we go.
Every once in a while, you get solid LED bro vibes.
Right. Yeah. And then, so I was doing a couple of other bands and stuff like that. And I think at a certain time, Miguel, the singer, was looking for a front of house. And I was called back on that. Now, when I started that again, you know, I guess, you know, I was ready for the industry and I had the skill for the appointed time, and that was very successful. And from there, I started to jump around and started to get calls here and there, and that was it. And now from that point, I have gotten the opportunity to now work for, you know, the Queen of Pop.
Dude, how cool. I bet yes. That's a super fun gig.
Yes, it's a fabulous gig.
Sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, there seems to be, there would be decades of different records to make and hit, and how do you make those have the right vibe they're supposed to have, you know, with an iconic artist like that, and then also still sound like they belong at the same show, right? Because some of those records are very different sounding than the others.
I thought you said he didn't have the skill to be a sound guy. Yeah. Wow. He comes out the box with a question like that? Yeah. Are you kidding me?
This is my second time. Everybody says I'm the smart one. Sean is the smart one here.
Sean skipped audio 101 and went all the way to the final course. Sean, what a fantastic question. I've always said that there's two sides of audio that I've learned, the subjective part and the objective part. The subjective part being as you create a mix, right? It's what you feel, is what you want. It's what, there's no right or wrong to your painting. There's no right or wrong to
totally
to whatever, right? But at a certain point, it's going to have to be mastered if it's going to be released commercially. And in the mastering process, it is a specific thing that totally. You have to meet to be totally. Commercially, what's the word?
Viable or competitive. Or
viable, competitive yeah. Is a better word, right? Which is the objective part of things. Now, the thing with Madonna, like you've nailed there, you've got 40 years of such specific sonic footprint right across. Now, the challenge is to be able to have an experience that doesn't take you too far from the moment that it was created, and not too far from what's available today. Because remember, the tour has to also compete with what's out there right now. You don't want to go there and listen to a song or sound and be like, wow, this sounds like my dad's old record playing right now. Right? So my approach was to look at all the macros, all the big moves that's needed for every song, right? As far as triage or as far as enhancement, what are the things that are needed all around that will keep this within a plus minus 10 of deviating from the moment or from the time it was built? And then I went into anything specific per song, but keeping within that guideline. So it's like almost reversing the process. So you start mastering, but then you go back into the individual songs to make that, first of all, feel like a tour that's out today that can compare with Taylor, that can compete with Beyonce or Olivia, whatever the case is, right? To have it sounding that way, but yet not to take away from those sonic footprints that you would have heard. You know, she does a song, she does Burning Up, which is one of the first songs she's ever written. And I mean, if you listen to this thing, it sounds like it came out of that four-track Tascam that you know, with the cassette tape. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I've messed up plenty of recordings on those. I know what you're talking about.
There you go. Yeah.
I've butchered many a bands there. Yeah.
Right. So you know exactly what you're getting. That
totally.
You know, you're barely getting highs. You're getting all of this crunch. You know, you're getting, but it's like, wow. So you start from there. Then you got like Holiday's got a certain sound and this and that, you know. But one of the things that I've tried to keep consistent in the show is the bottom end. Because I felt like if I kept the bottom end consistent, as well as the very, very top end, then that brackets the whole show. And then in between, I can move things around. So
you know, can kind of keep it like, it can. You can stay in the moment and still use the mid-range to give it personality or give it its decade it came from or whatever. But the people are still dancing and jamming and having a good time and not thinking you're changing decades on them.
That's it. You got it.
Genius. That's genius. I love it.
What a great question. Wow.
Yeah, like, where do we go from there?
Yeah, right?
Yeah, right, totally. How are you doing that?
Well, I was going to say, I think this ties into the question I had is because I was doing a little bit of the research before it came in, and it said, like, I'm seeing there's an effect, a vocal effects engineer and producer credit on this.
Yes.
So I'm curious to hear a bit about how that works, and, like, are they working with you every day, or did they just, like, were the... Was that kind of a rehearsal thing and then they hand off to you? Or like, what's that whole situation like?
So the process that we went through on this tour was about 4 months of recording work, mixing work, building the show, right? This also involved an effects engineer, quote unquote. But what this person was there to do was to create as best as possible the effect throws, the delays, the reverbs, stuff like that. Now, it had to be done that way because the decades that are involved, there were different sounding effects that records were produced on. So we kind of had to mimic in the box, you know, with the use of several plugins here and there and so forth to come as close as possible to what she likes and what she was used to when stuff was being done. So that person kept on, and that person is also on the tour that's basically doing it again live in every show.
That's pretty cool, dude.
Gotcha. So like they're doing all the effects throws and stuff, and you
throws. I have the left and rights of the delays and the verbs, and it's up to me now to wet it as much as I want. And sometimes, you know, when the throws are there, I might, you know, accentuate it some more and depending on the moment and all of that.
Got it. And I mean, on the other hand, if you don't hit that throw on that one echo, you can just point to the guy next to you.
Yeah, or I just leave it up. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
When you guys were working through that process, were there any particular effects or sounds or things that you could not sort out with a plugin and you had to bring some hardware? Like in my particular case, I find it really difficult to replace an H3000. I find Absolutely. It really so, hard for something to make that sound for me. Were there things for you that were the same where you were like,
yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think Madonna, as long as it met the feeling for her, right? She understood the nature of the beast that, hey, this is just not practical.
That's so, pretty sweet.
Yeah. So just make sure there's a throw there, but I want the throw to last X long, you know, amount of time or something like that. And as long as it gave her that basic feeling and, you know, that result, she was good with it. Awesome. But you're absolutely right. There were times when we were like, yep, we can't get that one.
Totally.
Unless we go sample some stuff, you know?
Yeah, totally. Did you bring any hardware or is it all software based?
On my end?
For the effects. We'll get to you in a second. We're talking about your effects guy. Oh, you're not important anymore. We're talking about the effects guy now.
So it was more practical and feasible to be all software.
Sure. Totally.
Yeah.
As you're traveling all over the world and stuff.
It's traveling. Yeah. It's the consistency in the presets. It's the consistency in the auto-tune and all of that stuff that he's doing down there. You know, the recalling ability was what we were looking for.
Totally. All right. What about you? What kind of nerd stuff are you bringing to the table other than probably a cool desk?
All right, so starting with the desk, it's the Avid 6L,
mm-hmm.
And that's got some plugins on there, some Waves, also Soothe. And then I don't summon the console, I summon outside, right?
This is the nerd shit I'm here for. Talk to me, come on.
So I summon the Neve, right? And then from there, the Neve, I have all the inserts there. On her vocal, there is, you know, and I see this stuff every day, but I blank out when I think about it. But there's the 500 series rack, and that's got an SSL EQ, one of the Duresser. It's got also a Moog. It's got a purple 1176 version. And I believe, a Clairphonic. A Clairphonic for the high end and all of that stuff. When I found the sound, I took that and I paralleled that again into another chain on the 500 series rack. So that's on her vocal, cool. Right? And then on the drums, there is a Manly. It's the Numu, I believe, and an API. The equalizer was at a 550, I believe. And that now is parallel on a 33609 for the drums.
My man.
Right? And then on the music side, there is the Neve. What's the compressor with the blend on it? I don't remember.
I don't remember
it's a 50-something series. But it's
everybody at home is just screaming at their radio. Totally.
Ryan's kicking me because it's in his rack. He's been using it for his drums.
right.
Not knowing what it was. Like a 50, 52 or something.
Something like that. Yeah, it's in the 50 or something like that, or a 45, 52, something like that. Even these numbers, you know?
Yeah.
So that's there. And I use the parallel in that the bass and the keyboards go through there. And I use a parallel blend on that one. And also, on the backgrounds, I use a Fatso just to use, what is it? The compressor that's on there that acts like a DS or kind of high frequency suppressor on there. And on the master chain, now that starts out with an SSL diffusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I have on the insert side of that, I have a Manly, the equalizer on there that is the mastering version of what is that equalizer called? Good Lord.
The Massive Passive.
Massive Passive. Thank you, sir. Totally. I should know these things, right?
I mean, not necessarily.
I just go after the sound.
Like if it sounds good, it is good, right? Like
Yeah. The Massive Passive, then that goes into a Moog, the two channel Moog, and then that goes into a Clairphonic. right?
For the high end again, you're doing the high end and the clairphonic.
Yes, yeah, the high end and the clairphonic, the high end on the Moog with the sub, and then the Manly is just, you know, if I need to add or subtract anything there.
But plus, it's got a cool vibe, dude, with the tubes in it.
Exactly.
It has a character to it. It's got a sound.
Once you turn those tubes on, you know, you hear a brilliance that's, you know, like it's so smooth.
It's got an emotion to it.
Yes, that now goes through a fatso, and again, all I do is tickle the clipper in the fatso. I forgot to tell you, on the Fusion, I do use the saturation there, and I do all of that stuff like that in the fatso, and after the fatso, the clipper from there, that goes into a Verimute compressor. Right, which I tickle maybe 2 or 3 dB sometimes. And sure. Then from the Verimute, it goes to a Betamaker limiter. And again, I hit the clipper in there also a little bit hard, right? And now all of that is now resampled in the digital world by a dangerous convert.
Yep, totally.
And that goes to a lake processing, and then I send that over to the boys on the PA. I use the clipper and I use the saturation because, again, some of the records are up to par, some of it are not. And just to be able to bring the RMS up to, you know, a working level across the board, if I got 2 dB of peak reduction on the SSL, another 2 on the Fatso, right, and another 2 on the Betamaker, I've just increased 6 dB of RMS. You know what I'm saying? So it's like that, along with shaping and bending, you know, and control.
So that's awesome. Plus a bunch of tone, which is sweet, right?
Tone is like I couldn't explain when I added a piece of analog gear to a digital thing, whether it was a DAW or a console. You know, the ones and zeros will always be the ones and zeros. Yes, I get the emulation. Yes, I get the, you know, the sweetness of that. But there's something when you start to put voltage in something and you start to really beat on it and you find that sweet spot, like...
Totally.
I mean, on the SSL, like, if I hold it at Unity, it has a sound. And the moment I turn that output knob to 3 o'clock, I'm like... Oh my gosh, why do they even give you an option here? Why don't you just set it at 3 o'clock and leave it? I mean, for that music, right? For another, you know, engineer, it might be a different spot, but you're like thinking, totally. Man, these things have their sweet spots. And like you say, the tone and, you know, like I even hear a difference. Like when I retube that stuff and I play it and I'm like, oh, I wish these tubes could just stay this way all the time.
Yeah, right. Totally.
But yeah, it clearly is a benefit, and I do. And this is why I don't summon the mixer too. I do encourage people to, you know, to get away from the sterile sound of anything digital. It's sterile, and it's gonna. I mean, you can put the plugins to do whatever you want and everything, but they're still going to be. It's still going to be governed somewhere.
Sure, you know, totally. And are you just sending your subgroups out to the? To the
Neve, yeah. Sure. And then I blend that.
Killer.
Yeah, and I have forced myself on this project to stay away from too heavy of a plugin because of the macro moves that I was talking about. You know?
Sure.
If I did do anything, I fixed it on the channel strip of the mixer, which was on the digital side of things, and it gave me more flexibility. Right, to be able to dig in and stuff like that, and work with that on the first stage of the mix.
Totally. Right on. I'm going to need to duck out in a few minutes because I got to go deal with an orchestra rehearsal, but I wanted to sneak one last question in before I leave you and Sean to carry on with like the super nerdy without me. And I know... Because am I right that Madonna found you because you were mixing for Post Malone and heard it and was like, this guy's awesome, I want him? Is that...
Yes, that's it. I was doing Post Malone at MSG. We were on 12 Karat Tour and she was there. And yeah, that's where it all started. And she basically loved my work and said, hey, I need you to be on my staff.
Nice. And then, so the question I wanted to stem off from there then is, like, did you have a similar approach for mixing Post Malone, or like with the, because I see there's like some overlaps in style there and some very different kind of things there. I'm curious, like, what if,
how you approach value. I wish you had more time to, because this answer is kind of, it's kind of a really unique situation with Post Malone.
I mean, please, like, go with the answer, and if I have to tag out, it's fun. I get to listen to it later. It'll be exciting. Yeah,
so Post Malone, after the pandemic, the production manager of Post Malone and myself, we go back a long time. We go back all the way from Big Sean, right? There were some things that took place, and Post needed an engineer after the pandemic. When I got on that gig, I was given a bunch of dates, right? And my friend, the PM, said, hey, he calls me old boy. He's like, all right, old man, you ready to come out of retirement? And I was like, yeah, what you got? So he was like, I got these dates for you. Then he calls me back and he goes, well, let's say it was 6 dates. He goes, out of these 6 dates, I'm going to need you to do 2 dates. So I'm like, what happened? Did it get canceled? He goes, no, eventually this has become now a tryout. And I'm like, what? A tryout? I'm like, man, you know I can mix. You know I can pull the job off. Why am I trying out?
Yeah.
So he starts off and he starts to tell me everything. But needless to say, I did try out. There was a couple of other engineers that was involved in that. And, I'm not saying that I was better than any one of them, but I was picked for Post Malone, and that's how I got picked for Post Malone also.
Right on. And yeah, I mean, it's not about necessarily what's better. It's about what's the fit for what we're looking for.
Yes.
With both the technical chops and also the hang, right? Because the hang's got to be there too.
Yes, yeah. For sure.
So I'm gonna run out to go deal with this orchestra rehearsal, but I'm gonna drop that one more question in if you guys want to go, and then Sean, take it wherever you and Burton take it from there. But just like, I'm curious, like on the technical side of the Post Malone, like was it a similar process, a similar vibe to what you're doing, or were you bringing different toys for that, or
different toys? I did have, like, on the mastering side of things, I think I just had the Numu. The Verimu, I did have the Massive Passive. I did have the Better Maker on the mastering side of things there. And then on his vocal chain, I had a de-esser, a compressor, and I think I might have had de-esser, compressor, and maybe what's the retro compressor?
Oh yeah, like that's the stay level or whatever.
Yeah.
Those are sweet.
Yeah, so I think that's what I had on there. But the thing with Pulse is that the difference is that the level of triage was not needed, because Pulse is so recent in the sense of, you know, things were built already sonically in place, and it's just a matter of a lot of just leveling out things and making sure that the pockets were correct. Which
it all sounds more similar on that in this artist.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. We took about 2 weeks on Pulse to get that sorted out, and then we referenced it across a bunch of different speakers to make sure that was translating. And after that, that pretty much lined up. I mean, it started out with great stems there, great recording stuff. So that was an easier process. It didn't take a lot. So it was just, if I could have just did another 5% on what we were getting out the box, you know, on my end, mission completed.
Awesome, dude. So yeah. Nice when you get handed good stuff and you're just like, let's rip, you know?
Yes. Absolutely. And I was a part of, like, I remember it was myself, WFB, and Willie. We were all doing it, and as they were building the sounds and putting it in, I would be listening to it. I was like, all right, this one has too much, 4K or 500. Let's pull a little bit of that down. So we were building it, and as we were building it, we're fitting it in. So things, by the end of it, it was just so perfectly, placed together.
Dude, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. And how do you, well, like when you're preparing for two very different artists like that, how are you thinking about, you know, you kind of went through how you were thinking about Madonna. How were you thinking about Post when you showed up and you were like, okay, here's what I'm going to need to do for this. You know what I mean? Because you don't have 4 decades worth of stuff to do, right? Now you've just got to make it consistent night to night kind of a deal, right?
Right. Consistent night to night. But you know, whenever I listen to something new, the musician part of me first kicks in. What's the vibe of this song?
Totally.
Right? And what's the vibe of this? And I believe that whatever I do to the mix, it has to bring me into movement. It has to bring me into a vibe. And that's like, that gives me such an objective, you know, approach. But I'm being subjective in my mixing, but I have to get that feel. I have to make this move. If it doesn't move me, I can't expect it to move anyone else.
1,000%. You know?
Yeah. And I think I want to say that that's one of my edges, you know, because I was told by Stuart Price, who's one of Madonna's producers. He goes, man, you're dangerous. And I was like, why am I dangerous? He goes, you put yourself in the music. And he was like, not a lot of guys put themselves in the music. You become the music.
That's awesome.
And I get that from being a musician. You know, if I can't, like, it's such a thing to have a song. It's got words, it's got a nice whatever, but you want to go a step further as a musician, and you almost want to say, I want you to feel my emotions. I want you to feel what I'm thinking right now, you know, and I'm going to sing it this way because I want to impact your mind or your emotions a certain way. So I'll play this note a little softer. I'll play this note a little whatever. Or I sing a little louder, sing a little softer. But I try to see and learn that from my artists, right? And when in the building phase of it, I'm listening to the song, I'm like, oh, that can be impactful. This can be that. That can be that. You know, once I capture and envision the vibe, then is when the tools come in to create, because now I have a specific direction to go instead of
an end game in mind.
Exactly. So I'm building towards an end game in mind. So now I'm not fishing around to see what works. I got an end game, I do it, and then is when I say, okay, is it working? Did I do the right thing? You know?
Totally. Where you're like, I need a little more gooey or goop here. Let me find something navy to thicken it up. Oh, I need something more like precise and focused or whatever. Let me find API or SSL or something. Right. You're just looking for those
pretty much
things to impact your vision, right? You're like, I know what I want. Now how do we go get that? Basically.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And a lot of it is, once I get this static mix built to set me up like that, then every show starts with that. And it's just the automation part of me just moving things around, you know, and that's with the muscle memory of creating that emotion and movement.
Dude, awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. And then before we hit record, you were talking about a gig you're about to go do in a little bit with Madonna that I think everybody would love to hear about, because it was interesting to me. Can you chat a little bit about your run down to South America here?
Yes. So we're heading to South America in Rio to be on Copacabana Beach on May 4th. And this is charted to be the largest public gathering for female pop star, first time in history. And we're expecting an attendance in about 2 million people.
So no pressure.
Not at all. Not at all. But let me tell you this, Sean. As much as it is nerve-wracking, I could not express enough how grateful, thankful, and humble I am that I'm getting this opportunity, you know, and I can honestly say I've started where I've started, and to be able to come to this and to mix in front of 2 million people live is almost like, okay, there he goes. She's done. I'm done.
Yeah, yeah, dude. How cool.
Yeah. How like cool. I am so thankful. And you know, for those that are listening out there, I've always encouraged hard work, right? And skill building. Make sure you have your ducks in a row, because when that opportunity comes, if you're not ready for it, you know, it's going to be tough. And I also feel like opportunity comes to those that are prepared for it.
Absolutely.
You know, so our responsibility is to be diligent in our practice and our craft.
Yeah. Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dude, that's going to be so cool.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And did you say there was something like 1,300 boxes of PA on that show?
Well, we have...
You must have countries involved in trying to suss that much PA in yes. South America, right?
So absolutely. There's, you know, there's a lot that's going on here. It's to fit 2 million people, you know, we have done, like myself and my SEs, we have thought about a 4 square foot a person. And within a 4 square foot a person, how many square feet along, how wide this beach is going to be and how deep it's going to be. And we've calculated about just roughly close to 2 miles.
Holy crap, dude. That's a huge space to fill with a lot of people.
Exactly. So, you know, definitely over 10,000 feet, you know, a little less than 12,000, whatever the case is there, whatever the numbers turn out to be.
Yeah.
So we have specced out, some acoustics boxes, and I think the last count I got from him was close to about 800.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah. So now the challenge is, who's got 800 acoustics boxes anywhere around in South America? Or if the case is like, what we were prepared to do is just what we call the bubble, so that the most intimate part of where she's going to be is going to be consistent with the acoustics, because that's what we're using now mm-hmm. on the tour. So, you know, we kind of keep that the same. And then anything else that's going to make up enough boxes to fill. But sure, hopefully totally. We can get it all the same. If not, you know, we'll do that.
And is that all K1, K2 for you guys?
K1, K2. Yeah, cool. We're trying to make it, you know, one of the largest deployments down there at any given time also. So we're going for dude, all the awesome. Records for the moment.
Yeah, yeah, cool, dude. Plus, the LA guys are probably stoked to be helping out yes. however they can and get the marketing sure. on that, right? The pictures for and the sure. drone shots and the, yeah.
I am sure.
Yeah.
I am sure. Yay, it's one smart way of getting cheap promotion on my end.
For sure. For sure, dude. For sure. Well, I definitely want to hear about it after the yes. show too. So
for sure.
I'm going to text you and be like, yo, dude, did you freak out? Is it okay? Like,
Right.
Are you crying tears of joy, or are you tucked under your desk?
You know what I'm saying? Yes. I think from the amount of rehearsals that we have done, the only thing I am anticipating a little bit of getting used to, because right now we're touring with K2, mm-hmm. so we're going to jump to K1 on the mains. Sure. So I have to kind of get used to that. And this is the first outdoors that we're going to do. Everything okay. else we've been doing, you know, arenas and stadiums, whatever the case is.
Right. Gotcha. So not only what it sounds like out front, but how that sounds on stage too, because the K1 has a very different sonic footprint on stage than the K2 does.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So we've got those challenges to that we are expecting, but you know, hopefully we overcome them and, you know, we adapt to them really fast.
Yeah, that's awesome. What's your, you had mentioned your SEs just a minute ago. What's your, you know, relationship like with them and workflow with them? And how do you, you know, since the mixing is the thing that twirls your beanie, you know what I mean? How do you get your SEs to give you the canvas you want to paint on, so to speak? And what does that relationship and dynamic look like for you guys?
Okay, so if you know me, I have a serious side, but I never like take the fun out of work. at the end of the day, the bottom line is we're all professionals and we have to execute and we have to be consistent as possible.
Totally.
I don't have around me an environment that's filled with tension or anything like that. I like people to be themselves. I like people to be respectful of each other, you know, and we just create an environment of safety, a place where people can come and be themselves because we work long hours a day.
Totally.
We're, you know, months after a time. So there's no need for us to be miserable, you know.
1,000%.
Yeah, and we, you know, we try to feed off of each other's excitement and, you know, jokes and stuff like that. So that's that part of, you know, the dynamics. As far as the technical stuff go down, because of my massive background in PA rentals and deploying PA for all the stuff I have done, I am also on, like, I have been tuning PAs, I don't know, gosh, close to 20 years. You know, I mean, I started out with the, when Smart was with Sam Burkow way back, I think, in the late 90s. And then it went to JBL. Then I watched it go over to EAW and I watched it move around. So I've been using that, you know, for tuning for a long time, a long, long time. My approach is, I have developed over the years a target curve that I tune to, right? Now, when it comes to L Acoustics and my SEs, the job that I give them is to pretty much make sure that the sound I'm hearing is the same thing that's flooded throughout the arena. Within, totally. And I put a very strict criteria on that within a plus minus 3 deviation, right, of SBL, and obviously the same frequency tonality. Curve tonality,
sure. Yeah.
to be around the entire room. So that's my SE's first and foremost job. The tuning, we handle together, but we handle it based upon a target curve that we wrangle in every day when we switch environments.
Sure.
And that target curve, once that's established and the PA is tuned, it's going back now to my mastering side, which I may just do some tonal shaping back to what the mix should be like. So sometimes in the room, even though you've tuned to the target curve, there might be some high mid saturation, you know, or sure. some low end roll that's a little more than the analyzer is seeing at the moment. You know, it's in the movement of the music and so forth. That stuff I use my ears afterwards, right, totally. And wrangle it in. While we're run, and I use pink noise. I don't sweep, but while the pink noise is going, I'm also warming up my ears back again because when I do my training and my, you know, my studies, I use a lot of pink noise to calibrate my ears. And I found that to be, you know, more useful for me and more successful in my ear training. So while I'm listening to that and everything, I'm starting to hear, you know, resonances in the boxes that I know live there, resonances in the room and so forth. So by the time I play the track, I can pretty much rely on my instincts to be close enough as opposed to if I just started playing the track and relied on my hearing at the moment, which in my opinion or in my experience has lied to me before.
Sure. You know? I mean, it has to all of us, right? Like,
yes.
What you had for breakfast, how tired you are with how long ago you got off a plane. You know what I mean?
There you go. So yeah, all of those totally. Things, you know, and even when I'm in the studio, you know, there's, I run pink noise and I run a few tracks all the time just to warm up my ears. And then I sit into a mix and I kind of do the same thing on the road.
Totally. And what kind of a target curve or tilt have you found that you have landed on that you like in your tuning? Is it have quite a big tilt in the bottom or not necessarily, or how does that work for you? What have you found you like?
You have just asked me the secret sauce. Okay, secret sauce. Without revealing the details in there, if you started at 1K at zero, by the time you're at 80, you're at about a 12 dB tilt.
Sure.
But within the tilt, there's a dip. Also, right?
Okay.
So that's the tilt involved. The details now is I've always felt like 300 to 1K or 2K should be razor flat in any given system, right? Because there's so much stuff that lives in the mid-range that you do not want to color.
Totally. Everything is there. Everything's hanging out there whether you like it or not.
Oh my gosh. And if you don't pay attention, you're like, why? Why?
It's a party and you got to like do crowd control in that mother. You know what I mean?
Yes. And especially in Madonna's music too. Oh my Lord. You know? Like it's so much there. So that I believe to be razor flat. And then there's a shift from like the 200 and then it starts to gradually go up. And then there's a little more of a severe bend upwards after about 100. You know,
kind of like where the subs specifically are taking over to get
right,
more impact.
Starting to take over, correct.
Yeah, sure.
I think I want to say maybe 6 dBs above 1K is where 100 is going to sit around there. But sure. That's the curve. And then obviously it's C-weighted and then it rolls off from about 8K. Because I just treat half of the audience as being deaf anyway, so.
Huh?
Exactly. So nobody's hearing anything above 8K, you know?
Yeah, right, no, totally. Kidding.
You know, it's longer shows, even if you're in festivals, you're there all day long pounding your hearing, you know, and just to taper off some of that, you know, high-end harshness stuff also.
Totally.
Sometimes I do have a dip in the high mids. I have two curves and I would just play around the two, but I'd have them on presets just to hear. But once I think for the most time, what I personally have issues with is between 1 and 8K. Things that live there can just get gnarly sometimes, especially on certain P8s. You know what I'm saying? And you can really get annoyed after a while because now it's a mixture of the room. Now it's a mixture of this. Now it's a mixture. Like, how do you take the room out and make things sound like it's coming back from the speakers, you know? And totally. I feel like those frequencies there play a huge part in wrangling that.
They sure do, especially if you have high gain guitars in your mix.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
just... Yeah. Space eaters, bro.
Like, yeah, forget it. Like, where am I supposed to put this vocal now?
yeah, totally. Totally.
Yep.
Man. Crazy. Well, I think that is a super cool approach. And similar to myself and what a few other people that I know do is just, like, get it to a place that makes sense, right? Where you're like, okay, here's the ballpark in which I am comfortable working and works for my mix. Cause you've probably, if you are, you know, let's say plus 12, like you said, you've already got a little heat in the low end built into your mix. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Whereas some other people would have a lot more haystack or tilt, whatever in their PA, and that low end is not built into their mix. So it would, you know what I mean? It would be a very different experience for them, but that's cool to get like, hey man, whether or not this comes out of the box like this, here's where it needs to be for me to be comfortable. And then this needs to be the same place everywhere. You know what I mean? So that's sweet.
Yes.
So do you, SE get that happening basically at front of house or kind of whatever? And you're like, okay, that's what I want it to sound like. Make that sound everywhere. So he can now run all over this beach and go make delay stack 77 sound the there same way go. Too. And you're just going to leave him to it while you're doing other stuff.
So the good thing about L-Acoustics is that once you're doing the sound vision file, which is the stuff you do in the computer.
Yeah, sure.
It allows you to be able to put in your EQ points so that you can build a curve, right? Sorry if you're hearing the dog.
No, that's all right, man.
So you can start building a curve in there and having all the EQs and whatever, all the filters deployed so that when you do send it to the amplifiers, you kind of already start as close as possible to that curve. Once that's done and we verify it on the PA and in Rio, once we verify that, our approach is pretty much going to be, okay, if it's all K2s, then obviously we're just tuning one stack and we're deploying that throughout. Now, if we have several different brands, then what I've requested is that I have at least one stack close to me. I can tune it, balance it, same way again with the target curve, and then we'll send it into its position. And then we'll just verify the delay times and all of that after. So that's pretty much the most, I would say, standardized approach that we can do with this, you know? Totally. And the reason I'm doing that, and again, I use Pink Noise, is because I have not been that good yet of being able to just listen to tracks and say, okay, this is what... I can listen to the track and feel it out and be like, yeah, it sounds balanced. But, you know, I'm not from that school.
I'm the same, dude. I'm the same. I can definitely be like, oh, there's too much sub or it's too bright. Or, you know, I can like tailor it in macro views, but the micro stuff, I got to look at
the analyzer. Exactly. So I trust the instruments to do that micro stuff.
Yeah, totally. Are you guys finding it possible to get as many LA boxes as you need down there? Or are you probably going to end up with D&B and Meyer and RCF and whoever else knows JBL, whatever else is down there, just to make enough boxes to make it make enough noise?
The word is out. The fight is out. I haven't gotten a specific update as yet, but yes, that is the challenge right now. However, we have confirmed that within the first immediate bubble of what we need, it's L Acoustics.
Perfect.
Yeah, so that's good news.
So delay ring 93 or whatever may be something else, but at least the expensive seats up front all got what you wanted.
Exactly. That's it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, is there anything that I should have asked that I didn't ask that you wanted to talk about before we wrap up and not drag these people through 2 hours of us nerding about audio consoles?
Oh my gosh. Not that I can off the top of my head. I mean, wow. Anything that you should have asked. No, but I would say this, though, if I can lend some encouragement, absolutely, that, being a good musician requires practice, and being a good mixer also requires practice. We do live in a time and age now where you don't have to wait till the weekends for the club to open up to go mix, or the church to open up on a Sunday, or whatever the case is. We have computers that we can run DAWs, and we can download multi-tracks, and we can practice mixing from there. No?
Totally,
so
dude.
So I encourage whoever wants to get into this, that, you know, start your chops.
Totally. Burton, thank you so much for the time and for hanging out and sharing your story and knowledge and wisdom. And let's get you back on after your Rio show and see how it went.
Yes.
And see, you know, whether you survived or not. You'll be fine. I'm just being silly. You know what I mean?
I'm excited to come back and report, for sure.
Yeah, dude. Totally. Totally. All right, cool. Well, we'd like to thank Alan and Heath and RCF for, supporting us and keeping this thing going. And thanks all you guys for listening. Burton, thanks for showing up. That's the pod. See you guys next week. Edit at dog barks. Good dog. That's standard issue for us, bro.
I know what they look like on waveform already.
Yeah, totally.
And this will probably be the blooper reel.
Yeah.